Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Follow the money, the saying goes, so we will, where ISIS gets its cash and how they decide what to do with it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 16th of November. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. In Paris today, there have been memorials and gatherings and presidential speeches. There has been retaliation as well. The French, as you might have heard, started bombing ISIS targets in Syria this past weekend, including a training camp and an ammunition depot. Today, the U.S. bombed 116 trucks that it said ISIS has been using to transport oil. That attack, that second one, said to have been planned before Paris, was an attempt to cut a main source of funding for ISIS. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going with this look at that revenue stream and the other ways that ISIS gets its cash.
ISIS mostly funds itself from activities inside the territories it now controls. That's different from, say, Al-Qaeda, which has historically relied on donations from outside sources, says David Gartenstein-Ross. He's with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
When they control territory that's approximately the size of Great Britain, that creates a great deal of ability to get internal sources of revenue, ranging from natural resources to antiquities that they control to taxation on their population.
It's tough to say how much funding ISIS gets from each source. Gartenstein-Ross estimates the biggest piece of the pie comes from taxing the people in the territories it controls. Howard Schatz, a senior economist at the RAND Corporation, says when it comes to antiquities,
we're really talking about small items, so tablets or seals. And you can put those in your pocket. You can put them in a suitcase.
Schatz says middlemen can get the goods to private buyers or lower-tier auction houses. Routes for smuggling oil are longstanding, says Matthew Levitt with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Hidden bottoms to trucks that don't look like oil trucks. Literally hoses that are run across the Orontes River. Some of them are literally like garden hoses. Some of them are much bigger to move the product into southern Turkey.
Levitt says ISIS oil is often mixed with oil from other sources, so it can't be traced. And still other funding comes from ransoms demanded for kidnap victims. The majority of this money likely goes to running the Islamic State.
But they have a lot of money. If they want to be able to peel off a little bit for terrorism, they can do a tremendous amount of damage.
The funding sources for the Paris attack aren't yet clear, but Levitt says similar attacks typically cost in the thousands or tens of thousands of dollars and are often funded by criminal activity near the target. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Will McCants is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's also the director of the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World. He's got a new book out just a couple of months ago. It's called The ISIS Apocalypse. So we got him on the phone to dig a little bit deeper into this topic of ISIS and its money, how ISIS organizes itself, how it operates, and how it uses those resources that Tracy was just talking about. Will, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
ISIS is, I mean, it gets all its press, if you will, for being a terrorist group, but it does more than that on the ground, right?
That's right. Over the past 2 years, it's morphed from an insurgent organization to an actual state. It has a government, it has a bureaucracy, and we should think of it as a state. It's a state sponsor of terrorism.
And that implies a certain robustness of structure, right? They've got training officers, they've got people who are thinking about the money, they've got bookkeepers, all of that.
That's right. They keep detailed Excel spreadsheets of every single expenditure. They leave a large paper trail tracking who's doing what, when, and where. But prior to this past 2 weeks, they've really focused a lot of their attention and resources on state building, both in Syria and Iraq and in the broader Muslim majority world.
One assumes that they, like virtually every other organization in the world, has finite resources, and so they have to budget and figure out what they're going to spend their money on.
they do have finite resources, and it's shrinking every day because its territory is shrinking. They get most of their money from extortion and taxes, and they are spending it at a rapid pace on their war effort. So they are quickly coming up against a resource problem, and they can't do everything that they want to do in the region, so they have to think carefully about what they hope to achieve strategically from attacks abroad like this.
What will be the things that you will look for as an analyst to know whether, and Obama talked about this morning, the whole, you know, we're squeezing their territory so they will have less influence. How will you know that that squeezing of the territory is having an effect on their resources and thus their capabilities?
Well, we already know from fighters who are leaving the Islamic State, they are disclosing to the media that the Islamic State leadership is discouraging new fighters from coming because they don't really have a place for them anymore, and they're encouraging them instead to go abroad and carry out attacks. They also have a big pension that they have to pay to fighters and their families when they die. The fact that they have lost tens of thousands of fighters over the past year in their war with the United States and its allies means that there's a very long tail of expenditure there, which is also squeezing them.
Do these people get paychecks month in and month out?
Many of them do get paychecks, and it's one big reason why they've been able to attract so many foot soldiers, particularly among the locals in Syria and Iraq, where the economies are devastated, where a lot of young men don't have many jobs.
Do you think that this attack in Paris is a fundamental shift from internal nation-state building to using their resources for external purposes?
I do. Heretofore, the Islamic State has spent most of its money on state building in the Middle East. It wanted to inspire attacks abroad, but it wasn't willing to expend a lot of money or human resources to do so. I think over the past 2 weeks, however, we've seen a major shift culminating with the attacks in Europe. We can debate why the Islamic State has made that shift, but I believe that shift is undeniable. It was always a global jihadist organization, always talked about attacking abroad, but now it's making good on its promises.
Will McCants is at the Brookings Institution. He is the director of the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World there. His most recent book is called The ISIS Apocalypse. Will, thanks very much for your time and your expertise.
Thank you for having me.
On Wall Street today, pretty interesting, actually. Oil spiked a bit, which you might expect given Paris and geopolitics. Stocks, though, rallied as well, which you might not expect given Paris and geopolitics. All of which is to say, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. At the risk of repeating myself, because it feels kind of like I've said this a bunch this year, there was a huge merger today that we need to tell you about. Marriott is going to buy Starwood Hotels for a hair more than $12 billion. Out of the deal will come the world's biggest hotel company with a cool million rooms for let. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has more on what that might mean for the companies and for all you road warriors out there.
When you add up the Starwood's 11 brands, St. Regis, W Hotel, Sheraton, Westin, with the Marriott's even longer list, like Ritz-Carlton, Courtyard, and the bazillion iterations of Marriott, you wind up with some pretty significant economies of scale. Stephen Carvell is a professor at Cornell University School of Hotel Administration.
From property management systems, reservation systems, booking systems, websites, accounting, marketing.
He says there's a lot of money to be saved by combining those operations. And what about things like bath towels and little shampoos? It seems like when you're buying for a million hotel rooms, that should help you drive a bargain.
Once you're already the size of Marriott, I don't know how much of more of a discount you're going to get, but sure, it certainly won't hurt them.
But will the merger hurt us? A.J. Singh is a professor in the School of Hospitality Business at Michigan State University.
The good news about the hotel industry is that there's still a lot of independent hotels in our business.
Marriott may soon have more than a million rooms worldwide, but there are 5 million hotel rooms in the U.S. alone, not to mention Airbnb.
So even though it might resemble something that we saw with airlines, which is you know, consolidation means less competition, means service levels go down. My sense is it's probably not.
As for the different rewards programs, it's likely Marriott will do its best to keep Starwood's members happy. Because part of what Marriott's buying here is the loyalty of Starwood's often young and affluent travelers. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I think the long-term trend will be for Europe to do what North America has done, and that is to try to create a wall between itself and its poor neighbors to the south.
How Europe might respond, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 237 points today, about 1.4%, finished at 17,483, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 56 points, 1.1%, closed at 4,984. The S&P 500 gained 30 points, 1.4% there as well, 2,053. Airlines slipped a bit following Friday's attacks in Paris. American Airlines down 1.4%. United down 1.2%. Delta Airlines off about 2%. Marriott, Starwood, we told you the news. Marriott up 1.3% today. Starwood down 3.6% today. Big banks gained. Warren Buffett might have slimmed his holdings of Goldman Sachs, but Goldman shares up 0.9%. Citigroup up nearly 1%. Big oil up as well. ExxonMobil up 3.5%. Chevron bumped up about 4.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. French President François Hollande made a rare joint address to both houses of the French Parliament in Paris today. He told lawmakers he wants the state of emergency that he imposed after Friday's attacks extended for 3 months, and the debate within Europe over what to do next is only just beginning. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in Paris for us today. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
First of all, you've been walking around all day and all evening. What are people saying? What's the mood?
Well, in much of the city, things are pretty calm and pretty normal. But when you go into the neighborhoods where most of the murders were committed at the rock concert, in the pubs and the bars, and at the soccer match, there's a very somber mood indeed, and people are jittery. The enormous shock hasn't worn off. It's not just the scale of the attack. It's the fact that, unlike the earlier attack at the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and the Jewish supermarket in January, the victims here were random, as Marjorie Darcet, a young businesswoman who lives locally, told us.
Here, they just targeted us. I mean, those places I go every week, you know, the little Cambodge, the restaurant, those are places we just go all the time in, and it's just us they targeted.
Parisians at play, in fact, enjoying the nightlife and a rock concert and a soccer match in Paris.
Stephen, President Hollande said at some point in the past couple of days, 5,000 more police officers will be hired in the next 2 years. There will be clearly more security on the streets. What's that going to mean, do you think?
Well, the big worry, of course, is what it'll do for tourism, which is a huge business in this city. There is a danger that the wonderful atmosphere in this city could be a little soured by all this. Simon Coopers, a British writer who's lived in this city for at least a decade, he has a young family here, and this is what worries him.
You live in Paris to be near other people. You have a small apartment. You don't spend much time inside. You live in Paris to go outside, to be on the squares, to be in the cafes, the theatres, the football stadiums. This is a city with so much to offer on the outside. It's the public spaces. And when those public spaces are endangered, the city crumbles.
Talk to me for a second, Stephen, about the refugee crisis, how that's all playing on the ground there in Paris and what people are saying, because certainly some of the speculation is that this may not have been completely internal to France.
Indeed, the discovery of a Syrian passport, which the Greeks say was carried by an asylum seeker into Europe in October, has further fueled the growing anxiety, even paranoia, about the large numbers of refugees and other migrants who've been flooding into Europe. It strengthened the hand of conservative politicians like French lawmaker Jacques Myard, who's calling for a crackdown.
We need to control our borders. You know, the Schengen Agreement is not working anymore properly. It is very naive to believe that you can stop everyone at the outside border of the European Union, and we should maintain internal control at the national borders.
Well, let's back up here for a second, Stephen. The Schengen Agreement is that deal from 30 or so years ago that said once you're in these 26 European countries, you don't need visas, you don't need paperwork, you can have borderless travel. If that goes away, what does it say about the economics of the European Union?
Well, indeed. I mean, the Schengen Agreement was already in trouble because various member countries were closing their borders to stem the flow of refugees. But this development in Paris could be the last straw, says Douglas Yates. He's a professor of political science at the American Graduate School here in Paris.
The ideal of Schengen is doomed. I think the long-term trend will be for Europe to do what North America has done, and that is to try to create a wall between itself and its poor neighbors to the south.
In other words, fortress Europe and perhaps fragmented Europe too, which would be a terrific blow against the vision that's driven this continent for so many decades, the vision of a united Europe.
And especially with all the controversy over the single currency the past couple of
Indeed.
Years as well. So much
Absolutely.
Going on. Stephen Beard in Paris for us today. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
All right, so back home, meanwhile, you might remember that President Obama promised a month or so ago to allow 10,000 Syrian refugees to resettle here in the United States over the coming year. Today, though, after Paris, some state governors have been saying they are not going to let those refugees in. Even governors of Texas and Michigan, which typically take relatively high numbers of refugees, are saying no. We asked Marketplace's Kimberly Adams maybe the most obvious question about that. Can they do that?
So governors can't actually stop the federal government from settling refugees in their states. Ilya Shapiro is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute.
The states can't simply refuse to house them. And once they're legally in the country, the states can't line up at their border preventing entry of whether it be refugees or anyone else.
But they can certainly make people feel unwelcome.
What the states can do is cut off funding or stop their programs by which they're cooperating with federal authorities that settle refugees.
That can include housing assistance, language, and job training, which can make for what Ralph Steinhardt calls a cacophony of state-by-state regulations.
The power to regulate immigration is an exclusively federal power.
Steinhardt teaches international law at George Washington University.
I think as a legal principle, you cannot have states making these individual determinations. Where does it end?
What's likely to happen, he says, is that the feds won't bother with contrarian states. Eric Schwartz of the University of Minnesota says that just means refugees will relocate.
But also it's going to be counterproductive because the refugees who travel through these states after they were resettled elsewhere would be coming into these states without any federal benefits, and it would create, I think, even more challenges.
Because often, he says, refugees already have family here and want to live nearby. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Continuing with the loosely built theme of the second half of the program today, that is borders and their enduring importance in the global economy, in Europe, as the news tells us. Also, though, it's happening in Asia. China has a whole lot of neighbors, 14 to be precise, more than any other country in the world, except Russia, which also has 14 as it happens. The border towns of the planet's second biggest economy are crucial. They are literally the crossroads of China's growing economic influence over the rest of the planet. So today we're going to start an occasional series called Frontier Towns. The first stop is the city of Hunchun, which lies on a tiny sliver of land sandwiched between two of China's most important allies, Russia and North Korea. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz explains China has big plans for that city and the money from Beijing is flowing right in.
Just east of Hunchun, there's a tower. It's full of tourists, mostly Chinese, who have come to this lonely outpost to catch a glimpse of the world.
50 feet to their north is Russia's Far East. Across the river to their south is North Korea. Shugong, a tourist from Beijing, gazes south. The hills in the distance look different from those on this side of the river. They were stripped bare of their trees in the 1990s when starving North Koreans chopped them down for fuel, eating their bark. Xu thinks about what China must look like from the other side of the river.
They're probably a little jealous. We all look the same, but they must wonder why there's such a big difference in living conditions. I bet they reflect on that a lot.
Pretty soon, the North Koreans will have more to reflect on. China just built a $7 billion bullet train to the city. Leaders hope to extend the line to Vladivostok in Russia and maybe someday to North Korea. And while Hunshin is in the middle of a region with the slowest economic growth in China, the city of just 200,000 people attracted more than $17 billion worth of investment last year alone.
Generally speaking, they want to push as much stuff into North Korea as possible.
Adam Cathcart, a lecturer of Chinese history at the University of Leeds, says China hopes Hunshin's investment boom will lead to better business across the border.
It's a lever they can use against North Korea, but it's also a lever they can use with the United States and the UK and, you know, everybody who wants to sanction and punish North Korea. They've got every opportunity to do quite a lot of business along the frontier, and I think China wants to keep it going.
There have been roadblocks, though. The uncle of leader Kim Jong-un was North Korea's point man on China, favoring closer business ties across the border. His exuberance for China, though, was one reason his powerful nephew abruptly had him executed as a traitor 2 years ago. Relations have warmed since then. At a restaurant in downtown Hunshin, young women sent by the North Korean government sing songs about their dear leader and their glorious motherland. And a couple of blocks away at a market, Chinese vendors sell crabs, shrimp, and clams fresh from the waters off North Korea's coast.
The prices aren't very stable, but their seafood is cheaper and better quality.
Vendor Longming says seafood from across the border is popular because it's clean. The state of North Korea's economy means there isn't much industry to pollute the habitat. Long's husband runs a casino in the North Korean port city of Rason. Gambling is illegal in China, so his customers are rich Chinese tourists. Long complains, though, about her husband's North Korean business partners.
They're so sneaky. A while ago, there was a disaster in the town, so they asked us to just give them 5,000 tons of cement and 1,500 tons of rebar, all for free. What are you going to do? It's the price of doing business there.
Lucky for Hunshin, people from across the other border are a more reliable source of revenue. A Russian singer in a tight dress belts out a song at a nightclub named Berlin. Later, several other Russian go-go dancers join her on stage. Chinese and Russian businessmen tip the women to come to their tables for a drink. Larissa Mikhailovna, the singer, is from a town near Lake Baikal. She says many Russians have come to Hunshin because the cost of living here is low, as is the cost and quality of health care. She intends to stay.
I'm not saying it's terrible in Russia, but as a woman in my hometown, it can be dangerous to walk around town on my own, whereas here, it's no problem at all. The main difference between the two countries is that Chinese people work very hard, and in Russia, not so much.
Back at the tower, surrounded by Russia and North Korea, tourist Shugong thinks about these differences too.
Over here in China, the market is prosperous, the living standard high, and our quality of life quite good. Now that I'm here at this three-country border, I'm finally able to appreciate how fortunate I am to be Chinese.
With that, Xu bids farewell to the Russian and North Korean landscape, steps into his black Audi sedan, and drives home. On China's border with North Korea and Russia, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There's more from Rob and our series Frontier Towns on the Morning Report tomorrow, medical tourism to the Middle Kingdom. His final note on the way out today, for those who are worried corporate America isn't ready for the end of days, I give you Overstock.com. The company has According to senior executives and regulatory filings, a 30-day supply of food for each employee and for one family member for that employee. Also, enough gold and silver to make payroll for a while. It's all set aside somewhere in the hills of Utah. Of course, you live by the market, you die by the market. The company said in a filing with the SEC earlier this month that the global precious metals slump has hit them hard. What used to be almost $11 million in gold and silver for payroll is now just $10.2 million. So take that.
Marketplace is supported by Zen Banks, a global mobile multi-currency account designed to provide the freedom to exchange, save, send, or spend currencies when and where you need them. More at zenbanks.com. And by Avalara, tax automation for business. Avalara is designed to simplify business tax by performing real-time tax calculations and enabling automatic return filing. Avalara.com. And by Xero.com, an accounting solution designed for small business. With Xero, you can manage business financials on the go. Xero.com. Xero, beautiful accounting software.
All righty, that is all we got on this Monday. The Dow up 237 points today, about 1.4%. The NASDAQ gained 56 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 took itself 30 points higher, 1.4% there as well. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.